We're taking a look at the writer Henry Greene in this week's segment of our underappreciated summer reading series. His novels are frequently described as being among the most important works of English modernist literature, and during his lifetime he was quite well known and highly regarded. But in the four decades since he died, he's fallen into relative obscurity. Joining us now to talk about Henry Greene and to make a case for why we should still read him is the literary critic James Wood, who teaches at Harvard and writes for The New Yorker. Welcome back to our show.
It's nice to be here.
Greene continues to be a favorite of many writers. John Updike listed him as a major influence. When did you first read him?
I first read him at university, so I would have been about 20. And in a way, it's a cautionary tale because we were assigned his great novel, Loving, which was written in 1945 and could be seen in a way as the last gasp of English modernism, of a kind of English modernism that had been going for 20 or 30 years. I was taught it as a difficult text, fairly joylessly. I was supposed to appreciate all the modernist elements, the self-consciousness and so on, and I wasn't taught to appreciate the brilliant ear for Cockney dialect, the Shakespearean comedy, the joyfulness.
I remember some of the descriptions many years after having read it. I still think about the peacocks on the lawn.
Yes.
Because he just was such a vivid writer.
Yes.
In an essay in your book, The Irresponsible Self, you argued that English modernism encompasses only a small group of artists. In music, there was, I'm quoting, William Walton and Ralph Vaughan Williams. In art, Stanley Spencer. And in fiction, Virginia Woolf and Henry Greene. Why were there so few?
That's a good question. I think one reason might have to do with pre-modernism in a way. I mean, there'd been a kind of explosion, hadn't there, of writing in England, often by people who weren't English, interestingly, Conrad, Henry James, Stephen Crane, T.S. Eliot, Pound, that had already been stretching from, what, about 1890 to 1925, shall we say. Along comes Henry Greene with his first book in 1926, and he basically writes from then until the early 50s. And perhaps there was a quality of not exactly of exhaustion, but a kind of a second installment quality to English modernism that there already had been this great time earlier on in the century. I don't know. I can't exactly explain it.
Was he connected to the Bloomsbury group?
He wasn't really. I mean, he knew them. He's an interesting figure because he knew that crowd socially. He knew them by class. He was an aristocrat. He went to boarding school at Eton, which put him in the generation, a talented generation, of Cyril Connolly, Anthony Pohl, and George Orwell, just to mention the Etonians. But where, say, George Orwell came out of his experience at Eton with intense class guilt and wonderfully spent the rest of his life working it off, you might say. Greene didn't have any, there wasn't any political guilt, but he did have an intense interest in ordinary speech. And he went to work on the factory floor of the family firm in Birmingham as a young man. He dropped out of Oxford to do that. He listened to how people up in Birmingham spoke, and a great novel came out of it in 1929 called Living, which is largely set on the factory floor and is full of interesting dialect.
Well, why did he quit Oxford? It's so hard to get into Oxford. Did his father force him to do that?
No, when he worked on the factory floor, it was commonly assumed, because of course everyone knew that he was the posh son of the owner. It was commonly assumed that he'd been sent there as a punishment, that there must have been some kind of disgrace at Oxford, and that he'd been sent down. But no, I think he wasn't a particularly formal He didn't have a particularly formal mind, and that's borne out by the work, in a way, which has a sort of fugitive quality. It's not clear that there was any kind of systematic reading through the rest of his life, and there's no systematic writing about the novel, and that puts him, doesn't it, in an interesting angle, say, from someone like Virginia Woolf, where there's a clear need to do experimental fiction and to write about as much literature as you can in nonfiction. Green was happy to be a businessman. He became the managing director of the family firm and worked as a businessman for most of his life, writing these spare, interesting, often comic novels fairly rarely.
And in his spare time, I've read that he could work on, if he was in the middle of a novel and he was on a business trip to New York, he'd wake up early in the morning, write a bit, and then go off to the meeting that was scheduled for 9 o'clock.
Yes, absolutely.
But, you know, being compared to Virginia Woolf, as you have compared him, is not all that bad. Yet she remains one of the in the canon. And it's pretty difficult to find the Henry Green novels in any of the local bookstores.
Yeah, Green's hard to classify, I think. And that's there are several reasons for it. I think one is that he doesn't have a metaphysical cast of mind at all. I mean, you can read Woolf, you can read something like To the Lighthouse or Mrs. Dalloway, and it's not just that the textures and the form are interesting and beautiful, but that also there seems to be a writer there struggling to find a vision of life, even a mystical or religious kind of vision, I think, in To the Lighthouse. With Green, it is a little bit more like a Shakespearean comedy. There's the comedy, and that seems to suffice in a way. I don't see any evidence in his writing of any kind of, you know, what you'd call a world view. I mean, Loving, which I think is really like, it's the closest modern experience you can have to you know, As You Like It or Midsummer Night's Dream or something like that, is just joyfully itself. It's a novel about set in an Irish castle. Kind of upstairs, downstairs book, but 80% of it is taken up with the downstairs, with the servants, who are all imported Londoners, so all the dialect is Cockney speech, and fantastically well reproduced. I can't think of a 20th century English writer who was as good at speech as Henry Green was.
Well, you say that he was influenced by both Shakespeare and Chekhov, and of course they're both playwrights.
Yes, I think that's telling. I mean, I've always been itching to take Loving and try to do a dramatized version of it. There was a BBC version a few years ago, but I don't think it was particularly interesting. But it's completely alive. I mean, he finds all kinds of new words like draggers fronts, F-R-O-N-T-S, fronts to describe women's breasts. At one point, the servant walks into her mistress's room, the lady of the house, or the daughter of the lady of the house, and surprises her in bed with another man who is not her husband. And she sits up and is naked in bed, and the servant sees the lady's breasts and runs out and then tells the butler that she's seen Mrs. Jack's breasts bobbling at me like a pair of, her fronts bobbling at me like a pair of geese. It's fantastic kind of a magical inventiveness that he has with dialect.
Well, his writing has been described as classless. And he does write about all the different classes. Do you think it's because he was very aware of the British class system and just wanted to understand why each of them was so separate from the other?
I think so. He also believed quite strongly as a kind of literary principle that ordinary speech, and by that I suppose he meant regional and dialect speech that hadn't been, sort of clarified and prettified into received pronunciation, was more interesting and more musical and poetic than the kind of speech that he had grown up with. His father, who was an aristocrat but a scholar, too, a classical scholar, had been very interested in how the servants that were around them, they lived on a big estate, spoke, and had actually made a dictionary of the strange phrases. And Green, in his memoir, Pack My Bag, which he wrote at the outset of the Second World War, says in that book that he's convinced that ordinary speech is more interesting than his own. The kind of thing he quotes in Pack My Bag is a laborer at the factory saying something like, "His eyes started out of his head like a little dog's testicles." There's a kind of immediate poetry, I suppose an unselfconscious grasp of simile and metaphor that he seemed to love and was able to mobilize when he wrote Loving.
But you say his prose, constructed, of course, with utmost care, has an air of carelessness. So yeah. He was purposely making it sound like it was effortless and not well composed.
Yes. I mean, that may be another reason, for his relative obscurity. I think actually, although he's a funnier and more joyful writer than Virginia Woolf, he's also a more difficult one in the end. Woolf has her difficulties, the long sentences, the parentheses, the slightly angled approach to consciousness and so on. But Green had a kind of, it can seem like mannerism. He had a desire, for instance, not to use too much punctuation. So I think Gertrude Stein was an influence on him when he was a young writer. The sentences can need rereading. And as he got older, the last few novels, which were not about working class people but were about his own upper class crowd, are so spare. I mean, there's no commentary. They're almost like plays. that there's a kind of experimental quality to them too. That I mean, they pose their own difficulties because they seem to offer the reader no help. It's a little bit like sort of Pinter and Noel Coward coming together. You have to read the pauses and the gaps between the speech because there's so little authorial commentary.
I'm talking with literary critic and novelist James Wood, who teaches at Harvard, writes for The New Yorker. We're talking about Henry Green, who is today's subject on our summer reading series called Underappreciated. He was born Henry Vincent York. Why did he assume a pen name?
He was, throughout his life, very uninterested in the usual elements of authorial success. When he had a photograph taken by Cecil Beaton for publicity purposes, he had Beaton take it from behind, so you just see the shoulders and the back of the head of the writer. And in a way, I think that was a kind of literary principle in the books, too. He had this hatred of, as I said, of authorial commentary. I mean, he hated that thing where the novelist comes in and says, she felt upset that he was leaving her for the seventh time. he hated qualifying adverbs. She moaned grandiloquently. He exclaimed excitedly. Those had to be got rid of. He felt there was no need for the writer to point things out to the reader in that way.
Well, then how did he deal with the matter of I in his memoir, Pack My Bag?
Well, he's strange that way. He does write about himself, but there is a peculiar way in which he's slightly palming. It's not written in the third person, but it might almost be. It's as if he's palming it off onto someone else, even though he does describe the estate that he was born in, going to boarding school at Eton and early days at Oxford, then the factory. But it has that strange, drifting, fugitive green quality. I mean, for instance, I remember that he describes Sundays at boarding school, and there's just a single sentence in which he says, Sundays smelt different. I don't know why. It's just a sort of, you know, you look at it and you think, no, that's a very peculiar way of reading the world. But that's Green for you.
Was plot important to him?
Not really. If you look at Party Going, which is a novel set essentially at a London station, where a group of upper class kind of 1930s party goers have gathered to get the train to France and have been stuck because of fog. So they make the best of it. They check into a hotel and essentially have their party in the hotel. If you look at that book, or you look at Loving, or the factory book Living, which was published in the late 20s, he likes plots that are almost foolish. Loving revolves around essentially the loss of a ring. The lady of the manor loses her ring. She accuses one of the servants. She gets it back. That's the plot, insofar as there is one. So again, that's a kind of, could be seen as a difficulty for contemporary readers. You have to put up with a certain amount of drifting.
Well, an interview in the Paris Review once asked him, "I've heard it remarked that your work is too sophisticated for American readers, in that it offers no scenes of violence, and too subtle in that its message is somewhat veiled. What do you say?" And he answered, "Unlike the wilds of Texas, there's very little violence over here. A bit of child killing, of course, but no straight shooting." he began his first novel, Blindness, he wrote when he was 18. It was published when he was 21 in 1926. And between 1926 and 52, he published 9 novels and a memoir. But then he died in 1973 at the age of 68. Why didn't he write during those final 21 years? Did he just quit writing when he was 47 years old?
Well, he was an alcoholic, and he also suffered, I think, from severe agoraphobia in the last few years, and depression. The last few years are very bleak. He wouldn't leave the house and sat at home in a dressing gown watching the television, which is not the way that one likes to think of one's favorite writer ending his life. So I think that a certain number of you know, biographical facts have to do, grim facts have to do with that failure. But again, it's the strangeness of the career. It doesn't follow contemporary patterns, and it's quite possible, it seems to me, that Green felt after 9 novels that he had nothing more to say, that he didn't have any interesting way to do it, and that was that. I mean, when his American publisher, on the back of the success of Loving, tried to get him to agree to be published in paperback in America, in a supremely aristocratic way, he said, "No, I don't think that's such a good idea." He wasn't even interested in enlarging his readership.
Is he still read in England?
I think so, though I wouldn't say he's much more known in England than he is in America. It's he lives on the largesse of the occasional essay by a critic or wonderful promotion of a fellow writer like John Updike. And so there are little blips and boosts, I think, every so often when his book gets taken up and maybe put on an English course. And then he just falls back into the soft obscurity again.
Well, right now, you can't buy the book singly. There's a compilation of 3 of his novels, Loving, Living,
right,
Party Going, published by Penguin 20th Century Classics. Would you consider them the 3 best?
That's the 3 I would get. And I would also get this beautiful memoir, Pack My Bag. He was convinced at the beginning of the war that it was all over, that he and obviously his generation would be called up and that they would all die. And this is a kind of elegy in advance for what he knows is going to disappear. So there's beautiful writing about the English countryside, his memories of being a child and walking along the lanes and so on. It's a really moving book.
And you can find it on Amazon and elsewhere if you look carefully, along with these books. James Wood, thank you so much for talking about Henry Green with us today on our Underappreciated Summer Reading Series.
Great pleasure.